Okay, good evening and welcome back, everyone. Nice to have a crowd again. Didn't scare too many people off with the previous class. Please let me know, by the way, afterwards. This is good to go in order, at least to some degree or another. I have found that these principles that we're discussing really play off of one another, and I'm not necessarily sure that it works in any strictly linear kind of way, but that they bounce off of one another, and to some degree or another, it's hard to, let's say, work on one, or that one may presuppose another, but it is certainly worthwhile listening to the previous class, doing chazara on the previous class, if you've already listened to it. But if anybody needs a link to the recording, please let me know. I'd be happy to forward it your way. Last time, quick review right now, last time we spoke about two other principles, the first two of John Gottman's principles. The first of which was enhancing, I think it was, I think that was the word, enhancing your love maps. And effectively what that meant was getting to know one another. And although this might seem brutally obvious to some, and maybe to many or everyone, knowing that it is the case is not necessarily the same thing as actually going through the method of really getting to know one another. There are some great exercises that Gottman has on his website and just some questions that we threw out last time, but trying to make it an endeavor to try to get to know our spouses as much as possible. Indeed, we saw that the Torah equates, at least to some degree or another, the concept of love, or of matrimony at least, with the idea of da'as, and that one, again, presupposes another, that it is incredibly difficult to develop any sort of furthering of the relationship if we don't simply know one another all that well. And some of the things as innocuous as what's your favorite breakfast cereal to, you know, what's your lifelong dream or where do you want to be in the next 20 years are all fair game and worth really trying to get to know one another. That was number one. Number two was, I forget the verb, it was admiration and fondness. I don't remember what the actual verb used was, enhancing or developing, but trying to work on our admiration and fondness for one another. We spoke about how really we've already sort of been there before, that if we are at a point in our marriage where we're already married, then that means unless we were bound, gagged, and or drugged, or all of the above, then we came to this point for good reason. We came to this point because there were plenty of moments throughout our, let's say, courtship, when we really saw something very admirable in this other person. We saw something that was just so engaging and intriguing about the person who then became our spouse. Sometimes it's a matter of just sort of peeling back those layers and uncovering it all over again, recognizing that we already have the recipe for success. We already have the recipe for the kinds of things that we like doing with one another, that we like to do, that we like to enjoy together. There are already things about this person's personality that likely, even if they've gone somewhat dormant and have become buried under all of the other things and errands and busyness and kids maybe and all the other things that we do as married couples as opposed to just dating couples, but indeed those can still be sort of refound and re-engaged with and stimulated all over again. And that's certainly where we want to be, that for the relationship to develop, it is first and foremost we have to know one another, but then we also have to really like one another, and we have to appreciate the other person. And that second principle really does go hand in hand with the two principles that I want to talk about tonight, probably more the fourth than the third, but again, this becomes something of a challenge. Think of these not so much as, again, a linear map to one after the other. It's not exactly like Maseilas Yesharim here. It is not the case that one goes immediately after the other, after the other, after the other, but rather these are various dimensions, we'll call them, of sort of the full scope of what a working, healthy, proper, we're saying marriage here, but really, frankly, any relationship really needs to be about. And the deeper the need for the relationship, when it comes to the most important human relationship that we have, so it becomes behooves us to that much greater degree to make sure that this is still all in order. Okay, so let's talk about principle number three now. Principle is turn toward each other instead of away. Sounds simple enough, sounds basic enough, sounds probably even intuitive enough that if somebody is trying to get your attention in whatever capacity, then we would turn toward them instead of turning away. And I think that there is something almost very so stark about that that it's almost painful. Like, good heavens, who would ever turn away from somebody who is in need and somebody who wanted to vie for your attention? The fact of the matter is, we all do it all the time. The question is how much and to what degree and how much are we working on trying to correct that behavior? How much are we trying to correct turning toward as opposed to turning away from? Here's what Gottman speaks about. Gottman talks about how there are, throughout our interactions as a couple, and really, again, this is we'll talk about this as a couple, but I would encourage everybody to think about this as being really building blocks for any good working human relationship. This is true of friends, this is true of parents, this is true of siblings, this is true of children, this is true of neighbors. Some of these, all of these dimensions have to be there in some regard, but for those relationships that are the most important, we want to enhance every one of these to the greatest degree possible. But what Gottman speaks about is that in all of our interactions, in all our relationships, certainly when it comes to spouses communicating with one another, even pre-communication, there are what he calls bids for your attention. And this can come in a number of different ways, but effectively this is, let's say, a wife turning towards her husband or husband turning towards his wife and doing something to say, basically, I need you to look at me. I need you to talk to me. I need you to help me with something. I need your assistance in some regard or another. And these are happening constantly. It's not necessarily something as great and as grand of, we need to have a really intense conversation about the trajectory of my career, and I'm very nervous about it, and I'm not sure that I should really be doing this, and we need to sit down, and I'm very, very deeply worried about our child, and we need to think about our whole approach in chinuch, and we need to like clear multiple evenings to be able to have this conversation. That is a very intense expression of what a bid for our spouse's attention might look like. Generally speaking, it doesn't look that way. More often than not, it's just, I need a little bit of friendship. I need a little bit of support. I need a little bit of assistance. I'm starting to break down under the sheer brunt of all of the errands and all of the things that I'm trying to manage, and I need you to help shoulder some more of the responsibility. It doesn't always look the way that we would expect it to. And that is, in no small measure, what makes this so difficult, what makes this so challenging. If it was challenging enough to respond every time our spouse said, I really need your attention right now, I don't know about you, this is all going to be autobiographical, of course, but if it was really so easy that when your spouse said, I really need, like, 15 minutes or 15 seconds of your attention right now, and it was, okay, then stop everything and let's just do it, then that would be challenging enough. Unfortunately, the way that this oftentimes occurs, not even unfortunately, it's the reality of being human, but the way that these often come up is that they are not as overt as we would like them to be. This is not like the happy windsock man who's standing next to like the Mr. Tire on the side of the road, and he's doing everything that he possibly can to say, look at me, look at me, look at me, stop driving, crash the car, whatever you need to do, just be aware of the fact that it's right now four tires for $400. Come when may to you, your concentration, the person you were talking to, and your windshield, doesn't matter, just look at Mr. Happy Windsock, who's all of 15 feet tall in the air. It doesn't always work that way. It's not always as enjoyable. It's not always as pleasant. It's not always as humorous. And it's not always as overt. What they look like is, and really detecting them, I would say, is in no small part the challenge in the first place. So I want to talk about four different issues as to, or four different possibilities that might make some of these bids for our attention very difficult. If we don't pick up on these, then effectively we're saying goodbye to the relationship. Because, for two reasons. First of all, because these create access points to actually communicating with our spouses. Right? It's difficult to, we spoke about this last time, that the fireplace, that sometimes you think, oh, you know what we need to like throw a log on the fire. We need like that cruise to the Bahamas by ourselves, away from work and away from kids and away from responsibilities and everything. And invariably, what that can end up doing is just really smothering the fire. That doesn't actually stoke the flames. The way that we stoke the flames are those small bits of air and oxygen that we fold into the fire, and those come up hundreds, thousands of times over the course of a typical day. And if we are not sensitive to them, if we're not on the lookout, we can't even discern them, can't even recognize them, then we're really in dire straits. Those are all access points in our relationship, or to our relationship, to our spouses, to be able to properly communicate and properly actually build that relationship. So we really need to be on the lookout and need to learn how to detect them. And this really is issue number one. Issue number one is the subtlety. Issue number one is that it's not the happy green 15-foot tall windsock puppet man. It can be something like just like a shrug of the shoulders. It could be very, very faint body language. It can be a sigh. It can be a sigh. So understand that if you're busy with anything else, and well, we should be busy, right? That is real life. We're going to be doing a lot of things. I know I've spoken about it, but I disdain multitasking. Because I don't really believe that anything is getting done when you're multitasking. I think that overwhelmingly when we multitask, it's not that we're actually doing 15 different things all at the same time. We're actually doing nothing really, really well and really, really effectively. Having said all of that, sometimes the reality of life is that there are just multiple things going on. It's very difficult to have your antenna out and to know what's actually happening, and the idea that somebody might actually be putting in a bid for your attention when we're busy doing other things, especially when they're subtle. It can be a sigh. Who notices a sigh? Oh. You have to stop and think, well, what's going on? I might not even have heard it. It can be a look. It can be, you know, we spoke about eye rolling, but it can be like, you know, an eye roll at whatever it is. It can be just, again, you know, a little motion, a little movement, a little tug, a little kvetch. It could be a sentence. It could be a volley for the beginning of a conversation. It can be a weird day today. Okay, yeah, that's great. I'm sure it was a weird day today. Okay, fine. Without it being really impactful, without it being really serious, without really dialing the seriousness of the conversation up in the first sentence to an 8 out of 10, it can just be something very subtle. Seizure number one is that sometimes they can just be very difficult to detect in the first place because we don't even know that somebody's actually trying to get our attention. It's not like when your kid like tugs at your pant leg incessantly and just won't stop saying, hello, 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 and like, why did you ask me 15 times? Just once is enough. Once isn't enough, mommy, no. Once isn't enough, Tati, because I already said it 15 times. You didn't notice the first 14 times. Baruch Hashem, kids are really persistent, but less so when it comes to adults. Why? Because we're more complicated. We're more complex. We feel scorned. We feel scorned that for the first two or three times you didn't pay attention to me, so I'm not going to give you a fourth try. I said it was, boy, it was a really weird day. Not even tough, not even because I can own it, I can manage it, but boy, it was a weird day today. Oh yeah, boy, the kids, it's not what I expected. This day wasn't what I expected. That's it. You only get two or three chances, and then you're not interested, and now I'm done. So we're not really talking so much about the importance of, let's say, persistence or the importance of openness, but the reality is that sometimes these bids come in very subtly, and it can be challenging to actually detect them. Issue number two is distraction, which may go hand in hand with number one, but this can even be a more significant bid. I want to talk to you right now. Yeah, but I'm answering my email, or we really need to have a conversation. You might think we really need to have a conversation, but what we really need to do is look at all the amusing memes that all of my friends have posted over the course of the day, and I'm only catching up now, so you're actually incorrect. We really don't need to have a conversation right now, or that I'm in the middle of, or I'm watching the game, or whatever it is. Now, I chose this for a reason, because this is one of this is on my ever-growing list of pet peeves, that phones are there. There's a whole, well, I think, do I have it in here? There's a whole word for this now. Fubbing. You know about fubbing? Yeah. Oh, it's a big inyan, fubbing. Fubbing is a big deal. To fub? No. It's a phone snub. Fubbing is what happens when you're trying to engage somebody else in conversation and they're busy engaging somebody else in conversation. This was a joke like 25, 30 years ago. That if you wanted immediate medical advice while you're sitting there like bleeding to death in the doctor's office, you could really just go outside and call them from the payphone and get whatever advice you need, because they might be more likely to actually take the call than to see the person in person. It's not a knock on doctors or anyone or anything, rabbis, whatever you want to say. But meaning that sometimes just the sheer urgency of like a ping on my phone or the ringing of the phone, or knowing that the emails come in, or the noise and the sound and the action and the excitement of a TV screen makes it seem so much more important than this actual flesh and blood human being who's the single most important person to me in my entire life, but it just doesn't feel as urgent, and it doesn't feel like there's the same degree of need. So distractions are huge, a huge problem in just drowning out all the bids that might otherwise happen, even when we were allegedly supposed to, like, enjoy a glass of wine together. Number three is that they don't always come in. When I say, like, a bid for your attention, it sounds like, oh, how sweet. That's so nice. Dear, you know, it was a really challenging day today. I'd love to talk about it over a cup of tea or a glass of wine. Halavai. Sometimes it's, you have no idea what kind of day I just had. And we're all guilty of this. Back and forth, and right, and some personalities perhaps more than others. But that doesn't feel like a bid for my attention. What it sounds like you're doing is yelling at me belligerently. And now I just don't really want to respond. Every single head in the room is nodding. It's remarkable, right? Of course we're all nodding, because you have no idea who I'm married to, right? That's why I'm nodding. But that's the reality, that it becomes this powder keg over the course of the day, and it slowly builds, and it slowly mounts, and it builds, and builds, and builds, and builds, and builds. And depending on your professional situation and your social situation, it may well be the case that you did not have the luxury of letting your guard down with whomever it was that you were spending the rest of your time with. Meaning, I got yelled at my boss, and I got fucked by my coworker, and this, that, and the other thing, and all these terrible things were happening, but I was, you know, in the middle of my commute, and I was around other people, and I couldn't let my guard down. Until I was finally in the company of the one person who is allegedly more important to me than anybody else on the planet. Now finally I have somebody to yell at. So finally I have, here's my, you know, my punching bag. None of the other people, I couldn't yell at them. They're strangers. You I can yell at because I love you. So as absurd as it is, that is the position that we are sometimes in on a daily basis. And responding to that properly, or recognizing that that's actually, they're just trying to get my attention, can be very, very difficult indeed, very challenging. Finally, you have the issue of dueling bids. And this is when powder kegs have been building up in either corner. And that can also happen. And all of these can be mixed up. It could be with aggression, it could be without aggression. Sometimes it could just be some of those very sweet, you know, darling little bids of, oh, sweetheart, I'd love to talk. Oh, let's have a conversation. You know, it was a really difficult day, but you're saying it was a difficult day. Very calmly, very plainly, very nicely, very positively, sweetly enough. But I'm also doing the exact same thing. And then it's, well, you're saying it was a challenging day, and I'm saying a challenge. And everybody is just being very calm and very nice. But there's this competition. There's this back and forth, and there's this tension that continues to build and continues to mount, because I might even recognize at this point that you're trying to get my attention and saying that you've had a difficult day. Oh, you have no idea the day that I had, though. Whatever kind of day you had pales in comparison to my day. How could that possibly be? I was with these, tell me them all day. How could that possibly be? I was with our children all day. There's no way that you're... And then it just continues to mount and mount and mount and mount. And everybody's walking in feeling like, I need a shoulder to cry on. What are we going to do? Cry on each other's shoulders? Well, maybe we should. But that is another area where this can get very, very difficult. So it doesn't work as swimmingly and as smoothly in real life. It's not, you know, it's not a screenplay. It's not a screenplay where sort of everybody gets their opportunity to just sort of take turns, and you say the perfect line, and then there's a response, and back and forth, and back and forth. This is all happening in Baruch Hashem. We have very chaotic homes. We should have very chaotic homes. There's a lot going on. There's a lot that we do. There's a lot of involvement. There's professional life, and there's family life, and there's volunteerism, and there's shul life, and there are other things, and they're all great things, but what that amounts to is a scenario in which it's very difficult to actually detect what our spouse is really trying to convey to us, or even recognize that they're trying to convey anything at all. So let's talk about some possible solutions. And as is the case for this entire series, this is a blanket preface and a blanket sort of cautionary note for everything that we say. Easier said than done. These are principles that are important, that are worthwhile, that I firmly believe are a boon to any marriage. But just because that's the case doesn't mean that everybody... The idea here is more empowerment with tools that can slowly be inculcated and be folded into the fabric of our marriages and our relationships. It doesn't mean that we go home and now they're like, wow, there are a million things. I thought that I was doing half a million things wrong. Now I realize that there are a million things that I've been doing wrong. That's not the point. But the point is that we have opportunities to slowly but surely, hopefully, not just rectify, but develop and work in ways that are really to our own benefit, the benefit of our marriages. Let's talk about a first strategy. It becomes difficult because of some of those subtleties. I mentioned this this mashal last time. Consider it as seeking buried treasure. That if we go in from the outset with the mentality that I'm excited to continue on a daily basis figuring my spouse out. I want to know this person like I know better than I know the back of my hand. I want to know their every quirk. I actually thought of an even better mashal, but I didn't have time to put it in the keynote here. More than buried treasure. Anybody play poker? Nobody's going to admit to that. So when you play poker, I've been told, so I've read on a Wikipedia article, that one of the most important things that you need to do over the course of a round of poker, or the course of a game of poker, is learn one another's tells. It's basically money in the bank. Because if I can detect that every time you ever so faintly tap your right foot on the floor, that means that you're holding great cards, or if every time you get nervous because you're bluffing, you just ever so slightly scratch your elbow, that's money in the bank. Because I know what cards you have. And that's huge. That's just money in my back pocket. Imagine if we took to marriage in that same capacity. That as subtle as it is, that I'm excited, I'm intrigued by the idea that as much as I might allegedly know this person already, the idea that there might be some of these tells, just body language, just the kinds of words and sort of summations of how the day went, that actually are an attempt to say, I really want to talk, I want to share with you what's going on, then that's extraordinary. Meaning to remain curious, even about a person that we may have been married to for 40, 50, and 60, and 75 years, to say that there might yet still be something that I can learn about this person, if we view that as being money in the bank, as being excited to know what your tells are, to know how you're trying to get my attention, then hopefully, even as some of these signs remain subtle, we'll at least have the right mentality. We'll want to remain in a state of having the antenna out so that we can actually learn about the other person, rather than just say, listen, it is what it is. If you're not going to, put up the giant green windsock outside, then, it's no longer my responsibility. How intriguing and how interesting and how curious we should find it to be able to uncover some of this buried treasure that's even right there in our backyard. So how do we go from fubbing to not fubbing? I know this is a cliche, but it's just the reality. Creating distraction-free environments. And we live in a world in which that is largely impossible for huge swaths of time. But if we're not doing it already, then we need to start it. And if we've already started it, then we need to expand it. There needs to be moments. There need to be moments over the course of a nightly schedule, over the course of our daily grind with one another, when things just stop and there are no distractions, and we have an opportunity to be able to pick up on some of the other things that are going on around us. Look, the fact of the matter is this is also important for chinuch, it's important for anything, but certainly when it comes to a relationship with our spouses, the ability to pick up on what you're trying to tell me and getting my attention, it's also a statement that I'm saying that that it's worthwhile. That you are worthy of my attention, and that I'm going to park this thing someplace else, at least for a little while, in order to be able to converse, in order to be able to catch up, to see what's going on, even inquire how your day was, and be prepared to actually hear the answer. I would strongly recommend, and I've been, Chataya and Imazker Hayom, I've been better and worse about this at different times. This is really the challenge when nobody's watching and there's no accountability. Because when you get the actual phone call, let's say in the middle of the day, I really can be, as though she didn't, she couldn't notice, but I really can be in the middle of answering emails and continue those emails throughout the conversation. So even when nobody's watching, the idea that perhaps there are those 5 minutes, I'm on the phone anyway, right? It's like multitasking, right? This is where I have to sort of pinch myself, right? You're not accomplishing anything anyway, so you may as well get one very important thing done and done well. Have a conversation. How long is it going to take? 5, 6, 7 minutes we can spare, how much, really, even when we're super busy, how much time are we spending, you know, like, I don't know, checking baseball scores and checking Facebook and checking emails that are totally inane and don't amount to anything. Even though we're very busy and even though important things are going on, somehow or another, there are other things that still continue to creep in. What about a phone call from the spouse or making a phone call to a spouse in the middle of the day that's also distraction-free, where literally the laptop becomes closed and the books become closed and whatever it is that we're doing gets completely tuned out for the sake of actually having just a few precious moments in the middle of the day, because that there is no greater bid than somebody calling or texting and saying, I want to talk right now. Number three, so how do we respond to some of that anger and aggression, is really learning to ask questions. And this is really tricky. I think this is the hardest one, because it's one that doesn't happen in an emotional vacuum. Right? This is where the blood is already boiling and where the emotions are already running high. And why are they running high? You made them run high because you started yelling at me. You started screaming at me. You're telling me how miserable your day was, and I haven't been helping you enough, and everything's terrible, and why did we even think about doing this? I mean, this is too much to take on, and I can't believe it, and it's nuts, it's great. This was a swing from the chandelier, and where are you? Nowhere to be found. And whoa. I don't want to talk right now. So it is, in this instance and in this moment, the ability to say, and this is why I said before that so many of these really hinge upon one another. This is where you have to like lean in to that fondness and admiration. This is when you have to remind yourself that once, just let's everyone slow down. I know that I care very much about you. I know that you're really sweet and kind and wonderful and generous and you can handle all of these things. So I know that this isn't the full picture. I know that even though you're yelling at me right now, there's got to be like a good reason for it. So to try to just suck all the emotion out of it and go back to that space where things are emotionally powerful, just asking a few questions. I think very often the reason why we respond to anger with anger is the perception is that whoever is yelling and screaming is in the driver's seat. And I don't like that. You're not going to control me. I'm in control. So what's the most obvious, immediate, primal kind of response is you yell back, because I take control back. The best way to regain control of the situation is actually to diffuse it. It's actually just to diffuse it. To say, one second, what's going on? Why so angry? Why so upset? Maybe we can solve it. Let's work on it. Let's take 2 minutes right now, and we'll figure it all out. Was it something that I did? Maybe it was something I did. Maybe we can make it better. Maybe it was something else that happened. Maybe we can fix it. Maybe we can work on it together. But the ability to diffuse that situation with really just those questions. Why is this happening right now? What's going on? Is there something underlying? And by the way, this tends to be the case. This is actually absolutely the case in terms of human behavior. We tend to replicate one another's behavior. So it takes somebody to sort of break the cycle. That cycle of yelling and screaming can continue to mount. I once, I once totally, royally, I was a teenager at the time, so don't judge me too harshly, royally cut somebody off. And this was a big mistake, because it was a guy on a motorcycle. And I don't know if you've ever met anybody on a motorcycle, but they are a scary group. So I once cut somebody off, and he instead of just exhibiting whatever typical road rage you would usually expect, and then like I'm really sorry, and you know, kind of give like a tip of the hat, he followed me. Yeah. So it started getting pretty scary. So what I did was actually this was my in the last ditch effort, I just pulled over, and rolled down the window. And before he had a chance to say anything, I said, listen, sir, I'm really sorry that I cut you off. It was totally my fault. I feel terrible about you. Like, you don't have to follow me home. I was, you know, it was a jerk. I'm sorry. He said, yeah, well, you got to be more careful. I said, yes, I just told you that. I have to be more careful. All right, then. Have a good night. Yes, you as well. You also have a good night. And that was it. And typically when we're like gearing up for a fight, you almost want the person to come back to you, because then that gives me license to just up the ante that much more. But when you have the opportunity to diffuse a situation, more often than not, other person responds in kind, and it gives an opportunity to figure out what's really going on. Generally speaking, when somebody's exhibiting aggression, they want your attention for some reason or another, either to give you a stern talking to, or maybe just because it really has been a tough day. Okay, so it's been a tough day. Hey, let's talk about it. Let's figure it out. Let's sit down and have the conversation. And sometimes just calling a timeout. This is especially when we get into the rock'em sock'em boppers, yeah. So that when this becomes a case of dueling bids, that sometimes you just have to say, one second. Again, this is also just diffusing the situation. But we are both using each other as a therapist right now. That's great. But let's just, like, not, maybe let's not do it now. Let's just hold off for the next 10 minutes and, or 20 minutes or hour. Let's just, like, table this for the next 2 hours. Absolutely make time to talk about it later. And we'll do it right with, like, a cup of tea and everything. And let's sit down and just talk about it. And we'll decide. And maybe you switch, you know, so you go first tonight. And, you know, Mondays, Wednesdays, you go first. And Tuesdays, Thursdays, I go first. And then we'll be able to go about it calmly. But when you start to feel the sense that everybody's vying for everybody else's attention all at the same time, sometimes it's just better to perhaps table it until a later point. Again, I think just really intuitive kinds of strategies when you're not in the moment, much more difficult when you are in the moment, but things that we can, I think, probably try to keep in mind and would serve us very well. How important is it? How critical is it to actually turn toward each other instead of away? So this is an oft-quoted Gemara. I've spoken about it a lot before. The Gemara in Bava Basra, Daf Tzadi Tes Amud Aleph. V'chad omer p'neim ish al achiv, v'chad omer p'neim l'bayis. Two different psukim that describe the kruvim, the faces of the kruvim on top of the Aron Kodesh in the Mishkan, either the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash, it's part of the problem, really in two different ways. In one pasuk we find that the faces of the kruvim were facing towards one another. In another pasuk we find that the faces of the kruvim were facing out, towards Pnei HaBayis, towards the actual Beis HaMikdash. So that sounds like a contradiction. The Gemara responds, resolves that it's not a contradiction at all. Depends on the state of the people. Lo kasha, no question at all. Kan bizman Yisrael osin ritzono shel makom. Here is when the Jewish people were performing the will of Hashem. Kan bizman she'en Yisrael osin ritzono shel makom. And here is when they were not performing the will of Hashem. When they were performing the will of Hashem, the way that that was actually represented, symbolized in the Beis HaMikdash, in the holiest place in the world, was that the faces of the Kruvim turned towards one another, actually gave one another the attention that each one needed. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a melech with a melech malchei hamlachim, but he's a melech without a crown if Klal Yisrael doesn't turn to him. And the Jewish people, great, were really innovative and were great and wonderful and a really sweet bunch. But without a Kadosh Baruch Hu, what makes us special? What makes us unique? What makes us different from everybody else? It's our calling card that we have the closest relationship with Hashem. I just find it so fascinating, especially in this regard and in this context, that when you want to speak about a relationship that's really going well, that's really working right, is that the two faces are actually turning towards one another. You have every opportunity in the world for bid after bid after bid after bid. I spoke about it this morning. Today was Yom Yerushalayim. This morning I just mentioned that, you know, if I mentioned it on Shabbos also, sort of 52 years ago, HaKadosh Baruch Hu jumps up and down, waving his arms frantically, saying, "Hello, Nisim and Niflos, I'm giving you Yerushalayim back. Anybody interested? Anybody?" And it's very exciting for a while. I mean, it depends on how jaded we become. But it is the kind of thing that becomes very exciting for a while. But then, like, I'm used to it. I don't know, I'm just, yeah, like, I'll catch a shawarma in Yerushalayim and then, you know, a mincha, and then, like, I'm on my way. Without just realizing the magnitude, the immensity of it. When we are trying to bid for one another's attention, there could be no greater symbol that of a healthy, properly functioning relationship than actually turning towards one another. And this is not just something that ought to reside in the Beis HaMikdash and only speaks to the relationship that we have with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Amazing, amazing medrash in Vayikra Rabba. Rabbi Yochanan ki hava ayil lebeisa. When Rabbi Yochanan would come home, his own home, when he would walk across the threshold of his house, mena'anea, he would rattle the door, rattle something at the door, mishum shenemar v'nishma kolo b'vo'al HaKodesh. Because the sound, the noise made by Aaron HaKohen, made by the Kohen Gadol, the bells at the hem of his clothing, as he would come into the Mishkan, it would rattle, it would make a noise, it would be clear that he had entered, Rabbi Yochanan was viewing his home as being no less than the Beis HaMikdash. So if we really believe that the bayis that we build, the bayis ne'eman that we build, is meant to serve as a mat, I don't know, by the way, that necessarily that the bayis that we build is meant to serve as an echo of the Beis HaMikdash, or perhaps the other way around. But there is a synergy between the two, that it's meant, one is meant to model or parallel the other. If that be the case, then we need to be willing to treat our relationships with our spouses in no less sanctified and holy and important a manner as we do with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We need to turn towards one another when it is the case that our spouses bid for our attention. Quote from Gottman, which I think is very important. Again, this is not about shaming. This is a matter of sort of picking up on kinds of the kinds of tools that are critical to fostering healthy relationships with our spouses. One virtue of turning toward each other is that it is so easy to accomplish. It only takes a small gesture to lead to another and then another. We don't have to master this immediately. We don't have to become expert in every difficult, tense interaction and conversation, that I know exactly how I'm going to pick up on that bid for my attention. I'm going to respond in kind. I'm going to give you what you need from me. It's one small gesture after one another. Turning toward operates under a law of positive feedback, like a snowball rolling downhill. It can start small yet generate enormous results. When we get in the habit and in the practice and the desire to want to know when it is that my spouse is calling for my attention, it snowballs. It can start small yet generate enormous results. You don't have to turn toward your partner in a very dramatic way to see the benefit. Just get started and things will improve by themselves. Mirza Hashem. Principle 3. Move on immediately. Let's go to principle number 4. So, by the way, feel free again, I mentioned this last time, feel free again, at any point, feel free to stop me, ask questions, whatever you like. I feel it's not going to happen. Feel free, and also, if you want to talk off the record, obviously, by all means as well. But any questions or comments or the like, feel free to interrupt at any point. Principle 4, let your spouse influence you. This is the one point of the book, I found this fascinating, the one point of the book where Gottman himself, and admittedly so, becomes a little bit more chauvinistic. Meaning to say, I guess this is really inverse chauvinism, where he starts blaming the man more than the woman. And he says that this is really just a function of the research that he's done, where he finds this to be much more of a difficulty for the husband than for the wife. Why? Because machismo. That's why. Right, the idea that I'm supposed to be, you know, the head of the household, and I'm supposed to be the man of the house, and I'm supposed to be the husband, and I'm supposed to be the leader, oftentimes can, and he says, by the way, he has worked with couples from all kinds of different, very fundamentally religious backgrounds, where this can be overcome. But unfortunately, what happens in that role, and in that sort of, that mindset, that mentality, is that we start to believe that being the head means disrespecting everybody else. This, by the way, it's not just poison for marriage. This is poison for any sort of even hierarchical sort of relationship. You start to believe that everybody who, let's say, works beneath you, they're just a bunch of gophers, and they're just, I'm not supposed to respect you, you're supposed to respect me, that it only works in one direction. That's really poison for any sort of properly working kind of environment. Certainly when it comes to spouses. So here's a quote from Gottman. He said, even in the first few months of marriage, men, and again, it's true in both directions, but he found that it is more, tends to be more a difficulty for men and something for men to work on. Men who allowed their wives to influence them had happier relationships and were less likely to eventually divorce than men who resisted their wives' influence. Statistically speaking, when a man is not willing to share power with his partner, there is an 81% chance that his marriage will self-destruct. To be very, very clear, there is absolutely nothing, there is nothing about the most traditional division of gender roles between husbands, wives, fathers, mothers, that suggests that a husband should not be respectful of his wife. And by the way, vice versa. Right, this is sort of like the running gag or like the inside joke when it comes to Jewish marriages that, like, you know, yeah, the husband wields all the power outside the house and the wife wields all the power inside the house, right? That the husband can go and make, you know, very, very important presentation to all kinds of people who are sitting around the, you know, the boardroom table, and they have credentials and money to boot, and he's there and he's the captain of industry, and then he gets home and he's like, you know, timidly looking through the refrigerator like, am I allowed to eat this? No, you're not allowed. You know, then goes and, you know, cowers in a corner. I think there is a lot of truth to this. So anyway, this really does cut in both directions. But again, overwhelmingly, Lee Scottman has found from his research and his practice that it tends to be something for men to work on even more. I'm very indebted again to Moshe for this just amazing, amazing depiction. When we think about marriage, and we think about marriage that needs improvement, oftentimes what we think about is that we need to boost our love because marriage is predicated on love. Meaning to say that marriage is even one of those few relationships where there's, you know, where it's gone from not just a liking of the other person, but I'm supposed to really love the other person. So then how do you actually work on that? How do you develop love? Cruise to Barbados, whatever it is, right? You throw a log on the fire, an intense, a big, heavy log that might, unfortunately, completely smother the fire. The reality is that all relationships follow this trajectory. They all follow this path. The most basic of connecting points between two people is not love, and it's not even liking the other person, but it's respect. There can be no such thing as a relationship if there's no respect. That's just totally subversive. If I don't actually respect you, then we don't really have a relationship. I might nod my head and do whatever it is that you tell me because I'm afraid of you, but that doesn't mean that we have a relationship. First and foremost comes respect. So what can happen, unfortunately, is that respect can be completely eroded down at the bottom, which is really the foundation of the entire relationship. And what do we try to do? We try to just throw on extra love at the top. Okay, so what do we need? We need like a romantic getaway. You might not need a romantic getaway. You might just need to like talk to one another. You might just need to re-explore what makes this other person really remarkable and wonderful. You don't necessarily need palm trees. You might just need like, I don't know, chamomile tea. You might just need like a board game. You might just need to have a conversation or a walk around the neighborhood. Don't get me wrong, cruises to Barbados are awesome, they're wonderful, but they are not a band-aid for, or maybe it's just that, they are a band-aid, but it's not fundamentally building respect from the bottom up. They can be a boon when the respect is actually there, but otherwise it teeters. The entire relationship teeters and it's not well-founded, there is no base, there is no foundation. Unfortunately, the entire thing can topple rather easily. I think it is worth noting, when I was in Toledo, you know what I'm going to say? Yeah. When I was in Toledo, so my predecessor, Rabbi Garsik, was, the Rebbetzin was Sarah Garsik. So I think it was at my installation? Yeah, maybe, I don't remember. But he was just like the sweetest man. He said, Jonathan, I'm going to tell you the most important thing that anybody had ever said to me, and it's the most important thing that Hashem had ever said to Avraham. Kol asher tomar elecha Sarah, shema bekola. Whatever it is that Sarah tells you, listen to her voice. Why is this so important? It's very, and it just worked out very well. We're both married to Sarahs. But why is this so critical? Because I think really from the very, this is the first Jewish marriage that we're aware of. It's the first Jewish marriage that we're aware of. And I think that if there is any pasuk that will immediately debunk this idea, that what it means to have the head of the household and very traditional role for husband and father means that his wife is going to somehow or another be an underling who's just disrespected or is only there to sort of do his bidding, is completely debunked in this conversation that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has, or this mandate that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives to Avraham Avinu. Listen to Sarah's voice. As Gottman would put it, let your spouse influence you. Become more like the person that you've actually married. You found all these wonderful qualities in this person. You knew that they existed. They used to be there. Why would I want that to stop at any point? Why wouldn't I want to allow this person to continue to influence and mold me and shape me so that I can actually become a better person? Overall, what we need to try to get past, this is, I call this overcoming the Shmata syndrome. Right? This is what, like, especially, I don't know, it's true, I would assume in both, on both sides of the aisle. But, right, nobody wants to be a Shmata. I'm not a Shmata, you don't just, you know, tell me, I make the rules around here, I'm the boss around here. It's not a matter of being a Shmata. It's a matter of respecting the other person enough that, you know what a chus it is for me to be able, why is it that when it comes to there is no greater accolade that we could give any student than, oh, he's Mishamish Talmidei Chachamim. What does it mean to be Mishamish Talmidei Chachamim? It means running around, going through. I remember, like, I was so excited when, you know, my Rosh Hashiva and Rav Berzon used to ask me to go make him a tea. And you would, I'd go and I'd bring it and I'd come back and, like Yehoshua, you know, so excited to be Mishamish Talmidei Chachamim. It's, you know, give him what he wants. And it's Kavod HaTorah. But, I mean, this is our spouse. Our spouse. It's a zechus. It's a pleasure. It's just a question of whether we own it, whether we treat it that way or not. The idea that I have the opportunity to serve this person and to be there for this person, if we view it as a zechus, as an honor, as a privilege, it is a complete game changer in terms of the way that we interact. We're not constantly, this way we have our antenna out for wondering, what do you need from me right now? How do I help you? How do I make you better? How do I make our marriage better? How am I there to service you and there to help you? As opposed to having my antenna out, whoa, am I being disrespected right now? Wait a second, are you asking me to do something for you? Are you telling me that you need something from me? I don't want to go there, you're treating me like a shmata. I need to try to overcome that mentality to whatever degree possible. Bear in mind the following, that if we view every interaction as an opportunity to either win or lose, and if when we're asked to do something, we dig our heels and we say, they asked me to do that. I also had a busy day. Do it for yourself. What? Who are you to tell me? I have to be here to serve you. What am I, a shmata around here? So good. Good. You won. Who lost? Your spouse. You know who you're married to? A loser. How does that make you feel? We, to no small degree, need to and want to be, right? I had this eye-opening. Every probably teenager has this eye-opening reality at some point when you realize, it's that eureka moment when you realize that your parents don't define you. Ooh, it's scary for parents. What it means is that parents can be their own people and I can still be my own person, right? So that, like, something, oh, my parents are so strict about XYZ, okay, that doesn't mean that, like, I'm a neb or a nerd or whatever. They're very strict. All right, whatever, that's them, and, you know, I have to abide by their, like, so I can't just, like, sneak out of the house. It is what it is. Marriage is totally different. Marriage is the idea of, it's basher, it's zivuk, it's connecting, it's soulmates, it's actually becoming one unit together. We do define one another. We do actually accentuate the other person's personality. I am only, we are a couple, we are a unit. If that be the case, if every time there is a request or a bid or even a demand, if I then stand on ceremony and I win the argument, then I won and I'm married to a loser. And I don't want to be married to a loser. How does that make me feel? But if I instead say that, sure, I would love to. I would love to help you. That's great. I'm more than happy to help you. Now everybody wins. Now spouse got what they want and you're a prince or a princess. Wow. You just helped somebody out in their time of need. We would think of that as being a wonderful chesed opportunity if it was for the, you know, little old lady who lives down the street. But, you know, when my husband or wife asks me to do it, like, I'm a shmata. Not a shmata. I just have an opportunity now to give to the other person and be defined as somebody who is married to a winner as opposed to being married to a loser. So I want to share with you two Rambams. This is critical, just to see how far this goes. And there's backdrop here. So I heard this once from Rabbi Kahn. Rabbi Kahn, whenever he would meet with a chassan and kala, I don't know if this is still the true, I assume it is, he would give, you've heard of, like, his and her towels, right, and his or her bathrobes and his or her whatever. So Rabbi Kahn's wedding present is his and her Rambams. Doesn't mean a whole set. One Rambam. One halacha from the Rambam, that's his Rambam. One halacha from the Rambam, that's her Rambam. His and hers Rambams. What does the Rambam say? Here's the his Rambam. V'chein sivu chachamim. This is what the chachamim commanded, demanded. Sheyiyah adam michabed es ishto yoser migufo. That a person has to honor his wife more than he honors himself. V'ohava kagufo. And he has to love her as much as he loves himself. Why does he honor her more, and why does he only love as much as? Maybe I'm incapable of giving love, the Rambam believes. I can't possibly give more love than I can actually love myself, perhaps. Then Yeshlo Mavon, and if he has the means, if he has wealth, then Marba Bitovasa Kafimamona, spend on her. Buy her what she wants. Veloyata, this problem with credit cards, because then you could also spend even what you don't have. But in theory, but let the good times roll. Veloyata Laleha Ema Yesera, and don't impose upon her undue and unnecessary dread and fear. She should let, I can never bring anything up because my husband is just going to explode. Speak softly, speak calmly, speak kindly, speak generously. And don't be kvetch, and don't be sad, and don't be depressed, and don't be angry, and don't be somebody that other people can't be around. Don't be radioactive. Don't be somebody that your spouse, that your wife, cannot get close to. That is how far the obligation goes of honoring a person's wife. A man honoring his wife. Her Rambam. V'chein tzivu al ha'isha. Shetia michabedes es baila biyoser midai. That she should honor her husband excessively. V'yiya leha mora mimenu. And she should stand in awe of him. V'tasa kol ma'asa al piv. And whatever she does, it's only if it's what her husband wants. V'yiya be'ineha kamo saro melech. And I view him as being a nobleman, being a king. Maleches betavas libo, marcheches kol mashiyisna. Whatever I do, it's because this is what he wants and this is what he desires. And if he doesn't like something, I'm going to keep it away, and I'm not going to give that to him. I'm not going to serve him something that he's not interested in, and I'll keep it out of the house. V'zed derech benos Yisrael. This is, by the way, really the conclusion for both. V'zed derech benos Yisrael uvnei Yisrael. This is the way of Jewish women and Jewish men. Hakedoshim v'hatahorim bezivugan. This is what it means to have a holy and pure partnership, a holy and pure union. And this is how you build a residence that is pleasant and that is praiseworthy. This is part of Avodas Hashem. Avodas Hashem is not only davening, and it's not only chesed to all the other people, and it's not only chinuch habanim is so important to raise our children properly. Treating your spouse. Men towards their wives, women towards their husbands, treating your spouse with dignity, with respect. This is the derech of Klal Yisrael. HaKadoshim v'Taharim b'Zivugan. You want to have a holy, a pure, a proper zivug. This is what it means to serve, to service, to be there, to have my antenna out, to wonder, do you need something right now? Are you trying to get my attention? Do I need to put away whatever it is that I was otherwise working on? Should I be here for you? Should I try to figure out what it is that's on your mind? Do you want to talk? Do you need a bowl of soup? Do you need a cup of tea? Do you need me to run some errands? Do you need me to take over the kids? Whatever it is, to be on the lookout, to be able to find ways to honor one another. This is the Rambam effectively saying that there's no such thing as being a shmata. There's no such thing as being a shmata. As soon as you feel like you've just been made into a shmata, pat yourself on the back. That means that you are doing what is expected of you al pi halacha to be a proper and caring spouse in the way that Klal Yisrael absolutely should be. One other point, and this is really a side point. I mean, even if this wasn't true, then everything that we've said still is worthwhile and still is accurate. But an additional point. Stephen Covey talks about this. I've definitely mentioned this before. We have two ranges, or two areas, that we tend to ruminate over. And this is what Stephen Covey calls either the circle of concern or the circle of influence. Meaning to say that I can think about things that I have on my agenda to do and to take care of and to make sure get done. I can also think about the kinds of things that bother me and make me nervous and make me upset, but I can't do anything about them. As much as I think that I wield tremendous influence amongst my family, friends, and neighbors, I'm not sure that I can solve North Korea. Covey's point is that if you can't do anything to really solve it, don't worry about it. Put it out of your mind. because effectively you're just burning up fuel that could otherwise be used for actual errands and actual activities that you can wield influence over, and instead, Nebuch, it's just going towards all kinds of things that you can't actually do anything about and won't become impacted, and they're just going to perpetually be there until somebody else does something else about it. Here is what's so remarkable. And here's what he says, here's what he asserts. I've certainly found this to be true, just experientially. If you focus exclusively on your circle of influence, it expands. It expands. Meaning, if I only think about the kinds of things that I can actually do, that I can actually wield influence over, and I focus on those things, and I'm great at those things, then wouldn't you know it, more of those items that actually were part of my circle of concern start to become incorporated into the circle of influence. Because what I'm basically doing is I'm generating an entire culture around me by actually making my base, my headquarters, very, very strong. And if I just spend all the time worrying about all the kinds of things that are on the periphery that I can't actually directly have any impact on, what I can instead be working on is making things better and better and better and better and better. And by being better, other people around me also start becoming better. And other people around me also start getting involved in my team. And the next thing you know, I actually can help North Korea. Meaning if presently I'm worried about North Korea, there's not a thing that I can do about it. Let's not say North Korea. But if presently what I'm worried about is, I'm worried about measles. I'm worried about measles. I don't know that I can really solve measles by myself. But you know what? If I'm passionate about it, and I tell other people that this is really important, we've got to be on board for this, and that expands, and you get some more people involved, and that expands, you get more people involved. The next thing you know, wow, maybe you actually can. Maybe you actually can solve it. Things that are unsolvable, at least in our present state, can become solvable if we focus more on what we actually can wield influence over. The point is as follows, then. That as much as it might be frustrating, that all of this points to, right, his and her Rambam, I didn't mention this, Sir Rabbi Khan said that he once spoke to, I think it was a chassan shortly after he got married, maybe it was a kal, I don't remember, shortly after he got married, and he was giving him just the whole write-up of everything that was going wrong and everything that he was upset about and everything that it wasn't what I expected, this, that, and the other thing. And I screamed to him, "You're reading the wrong Rambam! You're looking at her Rambam! Look at your Rambam!" And I hung up the phone. And that's right. Now, if it was purely a measure of avoda, that would also be true. Meaning to say, think about Avodas Hashem. We don't demand things from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. We ask how it is that we are supposed to serve Him. When it comes to our spouses as well, we could say the same thing. However, the reality is that the more we work on who we are and on being sweet and on being generous and being kind, the fact of the matter is we do ultimately bring more and more and more under our own influence in our homes. By acting the way that we want to be acted towards, we actually do begin to have that influence on everyone else around us, but certainly when it comes to this relationship with our spouses. What's the key? The key is don't look over your shoulder. Kol machzer al ha-gedula, anybody who seeks out, anybody who chases after gedula, greatness, gedula barachas minenu. It's going to run away from him. V'chol barach min ha-gedula. But if you run away from greatness, if you run away from covenant, from honor, and all of the accolades, then gedula machzer ha-sacharav. It finds him. So, story, somebody quoted this, somebody was telling the Simcha Bunim of Peshitta about this. He says, "I don't understand, I'm giving a kavod to everybody, and I'm giving tzedakah, and I'm being a marvit tzedakah, and I'm helping everybody, and still nobody's giving me kavod." He says, "Yeah, because you keep looking back over your shoulder to make sure that kavod is really chasing after you, and it's afraid of you, so it runs back in the other direction." Meaning to say, it has to be genuine. When we act in a way that is genuine, and your spouse has the sense that you're acting genuinely, not because I want something in return. It's not that I'm keeping track. It's not that I take out my phone and I like calculate all the points that I've earned over the course of the day, and then I can spend them tomorrow. But that it's coming from a place of genuine care and concern and sensitivity, and I want to be there for you. Invariably, we see that spouses respond in the exact same way. So I want to leave everybody with a challenge, at least on this principle. I think this is much more ripe for something of a takeaway. Challenge over the course of the next couple of weeks for principle number 4 and letting your spouse influence you. How is my spouse actually my role model? Really being influenced, right? Thinking back to that fondness and the admiration and the love maps and all that and the history and everything that we saw, but genuinely so. There are people that we have in our lives that we look up to. that we look up to. You're my role model. You're out there. I want to be the Baal Chesed that you are. I want to be the Talmud Chacham that you are. I want to be able to daven like that person. I want to be as caring. I want to be as community oriented. I want to be as selfless and as giving as that person. My role model. I want to be as successful in business as that person. Whatever it is. How is it that my spouse is not just somebody that I live with, not just somebody that I care for, not just somebody who I think, yeah, you're great, Shaful, you have great midos, yeah, good for you, you're wonderful, you're serviceable. They are my role model. That genuinely, there is, in this particular way, in this particular manner, in this particular regard, my aspiration is actually to become more like you. When we give off those vibes, it absolutely comes back. It absolutely is the sort of thing that becomes reciprocated, even if that wasn't the case. That's not what this is about. But this is about just appreciating and respecting that we are married to people who are not just, again, serviceable as spouses, but people to genuinely be impressed by, to look up to, and to actually be treated as our role models, to hopefully follow in their footsteps in some very, very important ways. We've got a room and a shul and a community full of remarkable people. And we're married to them. Let's find ways that we can actually follow in their footsteps a little bit. All right, everybody, thank you very much for joining, and looking forward, Mirtz Hashem, to the next installment.